episode of the Excellence Cartel. Ladies and gentlemen, today we are joined by Jason Coley. If you guys have been following me on social media, you know I recently hired him as my training programming coach because I wanted to learn a little bit more and get better in that aspect. I felt that was a crappy area. He now will be referred to as JC going forward because we have, at this point, two Jasons on the podcast, and it's confusing. But Jason Theobald, why I'm like sure. Looking at you, you're looking rather slim and trendy. How's things going for you the last 7 days?
Not too bad. Let's see. I mean, what did I do? I don't know. Things are kind of a blur. You know how that is, like, 12 days out, 11 days out.
Yep.
You know what? I did have a client in town. Ari and I entertained her and, you know, hung out and did the training thing. So that was kind of cool. We went to an FC Cincinnati game. I'm a big fan of professional soccer. And we had a box. My buddy Troy's brother owns a fifth of the team. So we were in an owner's box. So we did prime downtown, got a filet. I kept everything clean, though. Brought my rice, no, you know, salad dressing, pulled the croutons, no cheese. It was nice, man. And then we Ubered to the stadium, and then we took lines on the way home through downtown to get back to the car. So that was fun. So actually Saturday was pretty relaxing and fun. So yeah, that was cool. I signed like 4 or 5 new clients. I'm getting more bodybuilder clients, which is nice. So yeah, everything's good on my end. Preps feels like it's going well. So everything's progressing, man.
Nice. Jeffrey Sue. Oh, by the way, guys, we're talking about training today. I totally forgot to like throw that in there. They're going to be listening here and be like, what are we talking about? I figured I'd say
today. What's today?
Yeah, no doubt. Sue, what's up, man? Last 7, dog.
Not much, dude. Life is good. You know, I'm passing on, you know, business to my coaches. We're running like a one-time diet thing where, you know, they can, you know, people can hire one of my coaches to write them a plan real quick. We build them pretty aggressive so that you can get a couple pounds out of it. Try them out. I had my basement cleaned out today. I had like some old furniture down there that was left by the prior owner of the house that I needed to clear out. Yeah, no, it was actually really nice furniture, like a nice sectional. Coffee table, flat screen TV, TV stand, all that stuff. But I don't have any use for all that stuff. So I had a junk guy remove it all. I just trashed it.
Is the basement not finished?
The basement is finished.
So you get new furniture then?
But I'm going to redo the basement. That's my next project for the house. So we're cleaning that out. But other than that, Jeff, like not much has been going on. You know, I've just been chilling. You know, I haven't really been working hard like compared to earlier this year. I actually took a nap today, which is the first time ever on a Tuesday. And I haven't decided really to work with anyone directly right now. Like I said, if you twist my arm, I'll do it. But I'm not like feverishly trying to gain new clients. I'm just kind of cruising right now. So, you know,
It's a good spot to be in. Same as you guys, business is good. I have no complaints. The client trickle in seems pretty steady, which I'm always happy about. A funny note, I am actually going to my kids' school board meeting here in the next week or two to ask them why they put such a divisive policy in play to allow bullying to take place, because they had us parents sign a mask. Or
hey, Jeff Black, your internet's not working.
Oh, am I the frozen one? Oh, man. You guys got me?
For now,
your picture's bad, but wow.
That was really, really weird. I was trying to figure out what's going on. But anyway, I'm going to school board meeting and asking why they're doing a bullying policy because they had a sign for a mask opt-out. And then Keegan told me last night, he's like, thanks for getting me out of my mask because kids are getting picked on and like shoved and talked to and stuff. And I'm like, oh, well, I'll go talk to the school board. So I can't wait. I'm real excited. I can't wait. It's going to be a good time. Can you guys hear me now?
Nice.
Yeah, there's like a really bad lag going on. And I'm trying to get to it. All right, JC, man, I'm going to turn it to you. How's your last 7 days been?
Pretty good. Can't complain. I think the end of the last 7 days, I was actually out by you in Nashville, so that was pretty fun. Finished up from there, came home to business booming and lots of clients needing training and in training, and just enjoying life right now. So it's things are going smooth.
Nice. Well, guys, Jason, you want to tell everybody about AminoPure real quick?
Yeah. So AminoPure is one of our sponsors. Great company. Amino-pure.com. TEC 15. My favorite products by far, L-carnitine 700 mg per cc and the amino pump. The amino pump, actually, I've ran out for the last 2 days. I'm deep in prep. And literally, I mean, I can tell. It definitely helps give that nice pump, especially when you're flat. So I really see the benefit of it. So TEC, that goes towards basically some of our admin expenses for hosting our events, so our seminars. So help us out there if you go, TEC 15.
Guys, if you listen to last week's episode, you guys know we're doing a partnership with TRM every month. I don't think I need to say anything really about Matt. That episode really showed Matt in his skill set off. So thank you for tagging and sharing us in that, because that helps us out. www.matthewparkwith1t.com /TEC. And Matt will be doing out free 30-minute consultations for those of you who are interested in the coaching space who follow us. And then we got the PEC 5, Dallas fucking Texas, 28th, 29th. It's going to be a Friday and Saturday. We have some awesome speakers, but primarily John Jewett is joining our panel as a new face, and Brandon Cruz as well. We will be announcing all that will be going up on our site on theexcellencecartel.com. But really cool stuff we're looking at doing is we're going to do a VIP dinner and VIP training packages with different coaches. So we're going to have some different options for y'all. We probably pick maybe different restaurants where people could pick different coaches to go to the dinner with and kind of do different stuff. So I'm trying to make it a little bit more fun, because that was a lot of the feedback we got. Everyone wanted us to have more of a networking experience already than the greater one we were having. So we said, hell, let's just make it fun. So there we are. And then we're going to be meeting somewhere that Saturday night. As a group, if anyone wants to go out, we'll be going out with everybody on the town. So we'll make sure Dallas is a good time. With that being said, I'm going to turn it over to you, JC, man. Finally, I got to get you on here to talk all things training, my friend.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So give everyone a little bit on your background. I know it kind of like, what's your school and what's your education? What got you into all this? And we'll get rolling from there, man.
Yeah. I mean, I'm back for much like most people. I've trained in sports, played college football, got a couple degrees in exercise science and strength and performance. Came out of college, worked with a lot of really, really good opportunities to work with a lot of good professionals, not only in kind of exercise science, but in neurology and physical therapy, rehab, that kind of setting. So I've been able to kind of take and blend a lot of different approaches and kind of merge them together to kind of create what I think is a good approach to performance recovery and just hypertrophy training. So I've been doing this for over 15 years. My business is about 7 years old. It's migrated. In the beginning, it was more for strength athletes, powerlifters, because that's where I started out. And then it's progressed into more hypertrophy and kind of power building and bodybuilding. And now I kind of work with more so national competitors, local competitors, and IFBB pros in terms of training and programming and things like that.
What was the thing that caught your attention most to kind of start making you, I guess, start your business 7 years ago?
Yeah, it kind of fell into its own kind of need. There was a lot of people that were, again, kind of lost when it comes to certain things, training. A lot of it was injury related in the beginning. Like, I'm injured, and why do I keep getting injured? And everybody looks at the body as the kind of the beginning of that injury, when actually the training is the beginning of the injury. So if something wasn't managed appropriately, whether that's volume, intensity, things like that. And so I kind of began to look at a lot of the injuries and why they were happening. A lot of it was kind of because of that type of programming and training and the ability to recover stress and adapt. And it wasn't there. So that demand kind of built its need to be filled. And I started kind of blending everything together. And that's kind of how the business created. And now it's kind of boomed and going well.
So let's go ahead and kind of like start talking about training in general, because let's offer the contrast here so people can understand. where we're going to take this conversation. When I've been following you for a while because I coach Trina, and I've watched Trina's changes since I've been handling her nutrition side of things. And I was like, oh, okay. So I've been paying attention. And obviously we know Zach, but I remember when I reached out to you, it was the night after, it was the next morning after I got dealt third place or second place in my class, third in the other. I said, hey, I want to do this. I believe you're the guy to do it. Let's make it happen. When you looked over my original training, it was what, 16 to 24 sets per body part, depending upon what I was doing with intensifiers when I felt like I wanted to do it. And I remember the first thing you said to me was, you're way overtraining. And I've from that generation, like Jason and Sue from the 90s and 2000s, where we just came up on, you know, you did a body part a week, you blew it up, you rest and recovered. Peri-workout nutrition kind of came in. John Meadows kind of changed a few things along the way. But by and large, it's still kind of like a lot of volume. And then you see the progressive camp, but I feel like there's somewhere in the middle. And I wanted to say that was the first thing you said. There's like, there's this middle ground, and you showed me how to build progression along with how to properly structure my workouts for recovery. So let's take it down the road. You saw my programming. What went through your mind, and what did you realize we started to need to change with my emphasis being on better flow in my body and better legs overall?
Right. So again, you were just coming right off of prep. So I know, again, you were definitely in not a position to have an increased amount of volume in your training because you were just kind of shut down wise. So the biggest thing I do with competitors or people after them training is I like to bring their neural capacities up. So their strength actually up. But that's all relative. You know, a lot of people try and push volume because they're pushing food or they're pushing drugs, or they're pushing things like that. But you're just in such a parasympathetic state from kind of being and recovering from that prep. That's the last thing that you want. So I was like, all right, how are we going to push progression and how are we going to push strength in his program, but still yield results? And so we kind of did a needs analysis and looked at, okay, if legs are his primary place of needs, how do we structure that into his program where A, he's getting a better neural connection and drive with his legs so he can be strong again, but B, he's getting enough volume so he's actually creating growth. And so that's how that progressive block was kind of built. So wave one, week one is more of that kind of volume based. And then we progress linearly over the block to a more higher intensity, lower volume progression. And then in block two, increased volume and so forth. So it's a kind of a staggered stair step progression of strength, volume, and intensity. And that kind of leads to, again, as you're coming out of that prep, so not, again, dying right away with a whole bunch of volume and unnecessary stimulus or fatigue. And it just kind of gradually increases from there. So A, it was a needs analysis. Where are you coming from? Where do you need to go? And then how do we get there without actually crashing you or burning you? And then again, creating stress and adapting from that stress without having to kind of move backwards.
When you get an initial client, you start working on their needs analysis. Say, anyone just random. Do you find that they're doing too much volume? And I know you told me something that there was a lot of people, because I had it in my programming, a lot of sheer force exercises in them, where it was putting a lot of sheer force on my joints, because that was something you said when you were changing my hamstring training, because my hamstring training absolutely cripples me. Jeffrey Sue, I collapsed because of his hamstring training. So walk us through that a little bit. How many people are you seeing with this? Where do you kind of start with the needs and understanding how to unroll their training? And most importantly, I guess maybe coach them on the changes you're about to make.
Yeah. Most of the time, again, when I'm looking at needs analysis, is what have they been doing and what are the results they've been getting from that? And again, where they need to go and what needs to change in order to get there. So if they've been doing a higher volume approach and they're just not getting results, and the volume's either A, bullshit volume, it's not getting the job done, or we need to kind of hone in on that volume and decrease it to more of a minimum effective volume, and the technique needs to get better so they're getting more out of less. And 9 times out of 10, that's honestly what happens, is technique needs to be tightened up, volume needs to be decreased to a minimum effective volume, and then kind of we push that volume over the period of time to where they can handle the correct intensity, the correct technique, the correct amount of volume, and they grow. But a lot of the needs analysis is based off of individual needs. Again, biomechanics is a huge part of training. I think there's two camps. There's a heavy biomechanic movement geek camp, I like to call it. And then there's kind of more like a strength programming bro camp. But I think the blend of the two is exactly what needs to happen. So an understanding of the biomechanics and how movement occurs and how that differentiates under load, and then blending those two together to get the correct needs analysis, pick the exercise selection based off of that, and then again, progress those. So that's basically what I'm looking at when I'm doing the majority of those things.
Okay, guys, do you have any questions?
Not about how he trained you. So, I mean, this is kind of like your segment right now. I mean, obviously I will have questions about issues with my own body, but.
Yeah, I got questions about hamstrings. But
all right. Well, then I'm going to open this up into a wide open field. Let's go with, tell us what the difference is, because we talked about this before we started recording. What's the difference in your mind between working out and training?
Yeah, having a plan, number one. So I see a lot of times, and I see this with coaches in general, is they create a general basis. This is what you're doing for leg day. This is what you're doing for, you know, back day, XYZ body part. And then they say, you know, keep trying to push sets of reps and, you know, antiquated data over the amount of time. And that's not really a training program. That's just a workout that has some small progressions. Because when you're looking at the long terms of things, you're really not taking into account consistent stress and adaptation of training. And actually, I learned this pretty much from Jeffrey, honestly, in his class, his nutrition class that I took online. I wasn't there in person, but I did it offline. But he talked about, again, how he toggles between like different things, stressing and adapting in terms of nutrition. And honestly, that's the same approach that I take to training in terms of, again, something's going to stress the system. We have to be able to adapt to it. And then we have to be able to recover from it and then continue to stress, continue to adapt and so forth. And so continual monitoring of the training program is necessary. I think it's kind of, it's a little bit of a disservice just to give someone a program and say, here's 12 to 16 weeks of a program. Let me know if you have trouble with it and so forth. When, as coaches, most coaches are pretty consistently checking in on a weekly basis for nutrition, they should be doing that consistently with the training as well. So I think that's the biggest difference, is the communication and adaption of training weekly, biweekly, and so forth. I think that's the biggest difference.
Now, you said something interesting. I mean, you guys have a question based off that, since I went wide with it? I mean, I chucked a Hail Mary out there for you boys.
The difference between training and
no, did you have any questions based on it?
I mean, I think a lot of, you know, beginners just work out. They have no concept of, you know, planned progression. They just try to add weight to the bar and their form disintegrates and all that stuff. But are we going to be talking more towards like the advanced clientele here?
Yeah, I mean, I figured we'd be scaling it, obviously. So the way he's explaining it is, he was talking really deep about, and where I wanted to go was, you talked earlier about the adaptation with hypertrophy, and that was just a form of adaptation. Why don't you explain your thoughts there? And then I think from that, we could probably get more out of it.
Yeah. When it comes to actual, like types of training, there's only so many types of training. Like strength is a type of training. You can actually have a parameter of sets, reps, load, that create an adaptation. Power training is a type of training where it can create adaptation based off a certain reps percentage of load. Aerobic based training is the same thing. Hypertrophy is the only type of training where actually you can get results from either end of the spectrum. You can lift 5 pounds for 1,000 reps and get bigger, and you can reps 1,000 pounds for 5 reps, just throwing it out there. So again, it's not a type of training, it's a type of stress and adaptation. And again, the ability to toggle between, again, strength, hypertrophy, power, if you need those, or any three of those, is the importance of training. And I think, again, kind of Jeff said, which was 100% accurate in the beginning, most people are just kind of pushing one metric and not understanding how all the metrics kind of play to each other. And then most importantly, you can get strong off of just being brutally intense. And we've seen that with countless number of athletes. You know, if you look at big athletes like Dorian Yates, how complicated was his program? Probably wasn't really complicated, but he was just brutally strong and intense. And you don't have to have the smartest program when you're a beginner. You just have to be intense and do it correctly. But as you adapt and move towards wanting more specific results, your program needs to become more specific, and that has to adapt more specifically to your needs. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the biggest thing, is, again, you can see a lot of pros that generally have a shitty program or just maybe not the best program and still get results. That's because hypertrophy has a large range of results. So it just depends on what you want and what you need.
Jeff, okay, I have a question, if you don't mind me asking.
No, far away. Yeah, go.
So I think it'd be better here if we use some examples. So if we take, let's say, myself as an example, how I have weak hamstrings that are completely imbalanced to my quads, and maybe, you know, Jason Theobald, you know, Jason, you said you have some knee pain, right? Which prevents you from
training off season, but something weird happened and during prep, it hasn't been bothering me, but off season was brutal. So,
okay. So, JC, maybe you can, you know, use us two as examples, especially since we're older, right? I'm 37. Jason's in his 40s. We're not in our 20s anymore where we can just brutally throw weight around and, you know, put caution in the wind and hope that we grow, right? By eating burgers and fries after every workout. So what would you do for us? Like, how would you grow my hamstrings, and how would you help Jason with his quads given that he has knee pain?
Yeah, again, so I'm going to look at a number of different things first. If I do a needs analysis, I want to do a needs analysis based on your biomechanics first. So your movement under load and offload. So let's take you and your hamstrings, for example. A lot of times it's going to be looking upstream and downstream of that joint, of that muscle, so at the knee and at the hip. And a lot of times, what's going on at the hip, if we're not maybe able to maintain and keep a pelvic position that's oriented on keeping stress on that hamstring, or even if we have the ability of that knee to not be stable, we can't keep that knee stable, that's going to cause a huge kind of range of problems in between keeping your hamstrings. Next, I'm going to look at what's your exercise selection, right, in terms of your overall programming. So exercises that you're performing, are they from the lengthened position, the shortened position? Are you strong in the short, but strong but weak in the lengthened, right? And that's going to be a huge neurological thing. A lot of times people are really strong in the short position, but they're really weak in the lengthened position. And that lengthened position offers the most amount of tension possible. Mm-hmm. But when you have the most amount of tension, that's when you need the most amount of stability. And if you don't have those stability requirements, let's say you're doing an RDL or something like that, and you get to those end ranges of that lengthened position, you're going to offload that hamstring. You're not going to be having tension. You're not going to grow. So exercise selection would be first. And then I'm going to look at, okay, where's your volume at based on where you're at now? How long have you been doing it? If your technique is crap or not, we have to readjust that. Look at the movement exercise selection and then re-go from there. And then again, progress accordingly based off your goals, whether that's strength. I know you kind of do some heavier compound movements, almost like power building and blending of the two. So again, looking at keeping your strength high as well, but also growing that tissue. And then again, if it's a weak body part and something you want to grow, execution, frequency, and volume, we're going to start blending those three together in order to kind of get you some super hammies. Now, in terms of Jason, again, is this something that you've had like for a long period of time or just started developing like?
It's always kind of ached. And then this last off season, it was brutal. Like, I did not have a leg day.
Couple of questions. Is it like on the front of that patella, top of the tendon?
Front.
Below the knee, above the knee?
A little bit below.
Yeah, so that patella tendon. So a lot of times, again, if you're looking at knee pain, we're looking at the structures around our knees, mainly muscular structure, number one. Most likely the patella tendonitis is coming from the inability of that quadricep to actually activate 100%. And it's not so much the VMO or the lateralis that's actually not activating. It's more of that rectus femoris that drives straight down that knee and inserts in that quad tendon. So that third quad, that big guy that's deep to all those quads, it's usually weak in comparison to everything else. So I would test for that and see if that weakness is that. I would also look at your patella and see how that's tracking in terms of when you're loading and unloading your movements. And I'd look at the stability of your ankle. Again, is your ankle supporting the ability for the load to be transferred through that bottom foot all the way up through that knee into the quad? And I look at the position of which that is being used on exercises. So I assume it's only certain exercises, right?
Well, in the off season, it was pretty much every one of them. Now it's weird. I've been training it 2 times a week. I guess there's more supplementation in play. It doesn't really hurt. I can get through my training, everything I need to do. So I'm hopeful that when off season comes, it still stays, but I just don't know.
Have you pulled off your training volume as you've been, because you're about 12 days out, something like that now. So yes, you pulled back.
I did, but it didn't hurt at 8 weeks out either.
Okay.
Yeah. But I have pulled back now.
Okay. And any difference in exercise selection from when you started off season to pre-contest? You kept the same movements in?
Yeah. I'd love to be able to get back to squatting, but right now that still just hurts too bad.
Okay. Yeah. So again, I would put you through a couple of movements virtually and kind of see again how you're loading that knee in a nice knee flex position and then see how that load's being transferred. Because if that's not something that can't be fixed over time at all, especially if it comes and goes, that's a huge, great sign. If you have an injury and it kind of goes by itself, it's great. If it sticks around, then we have an issue.
Yeah, it's been going. It's gone right now. Thank God.
I want to fire something in that I want you to talk about real quick, Jason. That's the prep work you have me do. And I don't think I know Jason doesn't do it. I know Sue doesn't do it. But there's like about 10 to 15 minutes before my workout begins that you actually have me do workout stuff. Like, it's all activation. And I want you to go over that, like why you're putting that in, because that was a game changer for me, guys. Since he started having me do that, I don't have any pain in my shoulder now or my knees when I lift, like from that prep work.
Yeah. So again, it's that I just called it a pre-hypertrophy routine. It's just corrective exercise. Wanted to sound cool, I guess. But again, all you're doing is you're going based off that needs analysis. I'm saying, what are Jeff's limitations in this training structure that we have for the day? What needs to be cleared up so we can have the best possible output, stability, and so forth? And so that pre-training routine, I'm literally taking the neurological aspect. I'm taking the tissue contractibility aspect. I'm taking the muscle through a shortened and fully lengthened range of motion. And I'm kind of blending all those exercises together in 3 or 4 specific exercises. And that, again, kind of warms the body up on 4 different levels in order to get the whole system working together. On the other hand, what I found out that works extremely well is this is a great time to start sipping on any intra-protocol drink that you have and start driving those nutrients to training. A lot of the guys will just do it via like the beginning of the workout session, which is the same thing. But these beginning exercises are way more specific to the person's individual needs and training outcomes for that day. And again, it just drives kind of nutrients to that area as well. I found out that, again, there's only a certain amount that works appropriately. And then if you go overboard, you train the system. And again, you're kind of pulling away from the training routine. So maybe 2 or 3 rounds at the most, walking through that for each individual training session. And again, sometimes things will get cleared up and sometimes things will need to stay. So certain exercises will stay, certain things will rotate out. Like again, for Jeff's hamstrings, I know a couple of exercises right off the bat that I think if he did consistently, his hamstrings would have such a better connection. And again, just get crushed. Like for instance, the hamstring one where we imagined we were doing it with you, and it was in one of the videos on Instagram where you literally bent your knee and you brought your hip up in the flexion and extension. You kept your knee bent the whole time, like you're squeezing a ball behind it. And literally the hamstring just balls up and it creates such a strong contraction in the shortened length and range that you have no choice but to feel your hamstrings all the way through the entire hip flexion and extension range. And again, that's an exercise that would probably be great for someone with poor hamstring development, because again, they can feel that connectivity through the whole entire range of motion, not just in the shortened range where that stimulus or that feeling is high. So that's the importance of that. I guess I place some importance on that. I don't know if a lot of people do it with their coaches, but I've seen that's kind of made the biggest difference in terms of the performance of the people I work with. I don't want to call them athletes because they're not all athletes, but.
Do you believe that there's a time and place to train twice a day if someone's on enough anabolics, and will that overreaching produce results in a 4-week period, or do you think it's kind of bullshit?
No, I think there's a time and place for it. Yeah. Okay. I absolutely think it's applicable to a lot of different people depending on their lifestyle, their ability to get to a gym. Again, their ability to place recovery as number one in terms of those priorities, but yeah, absolutely. I think anytime you can break up volume and frequency into more prioritized, smaller periods, you get better stimulus. You don't drain into that parasympathetic mode so often because, again, you're not there for 2 hours at a time. And you can get out of that sympathetic mode and get more parasympathetic the more you kind of are able to kind of go in and out, in and out. And that adaptation is huge. If someone's never done it before, it definitely does take a lot of getting used to because, again, there's a lot of different structuring in terms of nutrients, food, nutrient timing around those training workouts. But if somebody has the time and ability, I've done it with some of my athletes and regular people who can't get into the gym for a long period of time, hour and a half, break it up into 2 45-minute sessions. Absolutely.
Gotcha. Cool.
Yeah. I think it's more beneficial in an off season, to be honest, unless in a pre-contest phase, I've seen some people do it and they substitute that training for cardio. It's just kind of like almost an increased style of meat, so to speak.
So
my other question,
go for it.
Someone with delts that take over in chest training, what are some of your tips?
Yeah. So you mean front delt?
Yeah, I guess it's my front delt. I mean, they all just kind of take over. They'll get pumped sometimes. I'm like, oh, this isn't working. So I guess it's front, but man, the medials kind of pump up too. It's just a really responsive body part.
Yeah, that could be one, A. And then I'm looking at your position and how you're training and executing that press. Is it on barbell, dumbbell movements?
It's more on barbell stuff. So honestly, I just skip them. I really have a hard time isolating with it. And so honestly, I just don't do them much. I kind of gravitate towards a lot of machines.
You're 100% correct. Again, barbell movements are going to be inefficient at finishing that complete adduction of the humerus across the body for chest. You're working on a closed chain exercise, right? So your hands out here, you're never getting that last emphasis. And so you're only getting a linear push straight to that. So depending on your ability to adduct the arm, it's not going to be an optimal exercise. I always like, again, I'm working with individuals. Sometimes we need to bring up a lagging body part. I'm going to kind of pre-fatigue that body part and get as much blood in that body part as possible with an exercise that goes through a fully lengthened and a fully shortened as much as I can. And then I'm going to put them into an exercise again, where then they can feel that chest pretty much by having no choice because it's full of blood. And that may be something that may be more like a dumbbell or machine press or something like that. But their volumes wouldn't be reduced because they're already pre-fatigued and the stimulus, no matter what, is going to be high, but I want to decrease the fatigue. So yeah, I think it's huge. I think it's common for a lot of athletes is I don't know how to, again, roll through my chest and get under the bar or under the dumbbells or under the weight. And I tend to flare more and have more of that kind of 90 degree, 75 degree elbow position where I'm pushing through my shoulders and I'm going with the weight forward versus me pushing away from the weight and coming through the adduction of my humerus into my pecs and pushing through the pec.
Yeah.
A lot of people
learned that, but it took me a long time, unfortunately.
Yeah. A lot of people will push through kind of a straight wrist position, right? But the more extension we get in that wrist position, the more we're able to tuck under that pec and push through the palm and just drive that humerus and arm into the pec as close as possible. Whereas if we were to stack that, we have kind of more of an internal rotated position and we don't get to complete that push.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've kind of figured that out on my own. That verifies that I'm doing it right. It just feels right. But man, it took me way too long to figure it out.
Oh, yeah, I know.
I'm still battling bigger delts than chest at this point. So, you know, it's always one of those things I'm trying to keep out. So
another thing that actually works is, and this kind of people don't actually do this a lot, is the more you can actually fire your rear delts and subscapula, the more you can set that kind of humerus back in the socket and give your chest more room to actually open and close. Okay. So instead of having that kind of forward rolled shoulder position, that humerus kind of posteriorly sits backwards instead of being thrown forwards. And you can actually get more length and more contractibility through that chest because you just have a pretty much a larger origin to insertion by having a different placement. So a lot of rear delt subscap exercises beforehand, not to fatigue because obviously you want that stabilizer to be working, but again, just enough so you can kind of feel that pump and you're like, oh shit, that shoulder socket feels real good. It feels real stable. Then I can just open up that chest and you really have something to push off of.
Okay. I'll try that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sue, do you have a question or can I fire off one that I think you might be able to comment on?
I have a comment on this one. You know, Jason, I don't know if you, Jason Theobald, I don't know if you do hex presses often or do you know, reverse banded incline, but no. I love those for chest because that allows me to feel it a lot. That abduction that you know, JC is talking about, you can really feel that with a hex press and just go higher reps.
I do use a hex press. I don't use any bands with it.
I mean banded, reverse banded incline
bar. Oh, okay.
I like that too. Okay. I feel those a lot personally.
Yeah, there's it's going to be personal to each, just like you just said. It's going to be personal to each, depending on their, again, their structure, their ability to, again, feel the muscle and the length in a certain position. A lot of exercises, you got to be careful, though, just because the sensation is high doesn't mean the stimulus is high, right? Yeah. So the sensation could be like, oh, that feels really good. It doesn't mean it's necessarily getting the most contractibility or you're using that muscle through the full range or even targeting through the length and or short. You know, this is something that we figured out with Jack is like, I do these a lot, but it's like, well, just because the sensation is high doesn't mean the stimulus is high. You can light a match in your hand and that sensation is going to be really high, but doesn't mean the stimulus is good, right? So just being careful with exercise selection. I think the one exercise Jeffrey's talking about, the hex press, is huge. I never use it alone in terms of context of just pressing by itself, but in the context of like a superset or a tri-set, oh man, it freaking burns. And it'll definitely pump as much blood as you can into that chest.
My next question for you, I'm going to ask probably the age-old question I think everyone wants to know, but what's the difference between programming women versus men? Is there one?
No, it's not. Okay. You're programming for human physiology. You're programming for biomechanics. You're programming for stress. You're programming for adaptation. These things are not difference between females and males. I will say this. When programming for females, they can take a shitload of work and not fatigue and or create too much fatigue more than men. They have ability to, again, have a higher amount of volume and not fatigue as fast, where men tend to fatigue faster having a higher amount of volume. This is just what I found kind of anecdotally. I have no peer-reviewed support for this, but just over the working with multiple athletes, I've worked with some athletes from both of these guys on here. There are people before. Women tend to be able to have higher intensities and higher volumes. And they can go for longer without having to deload. Doesn't mean they don't deload, but yeah, in terms of differences, there's not much. Maybe body part selection in terms of overall volume. You know, if you're looking for a figure athlete, you're going to be hitting more glutes, more shoulders, more things like that. But in terms of actual training and programming, there's not much difference.
JC, have you noticed in your female clients that they tend to not be able to train as hard, or they're more prone to injury when they're in their luteal phase of their menstrual?
100%, dude. So we were just talking about this in terms of with Trina. A lot of times, and I, again, learned this from you and Jason and all you guys will change the structure of their macronutrient content when they're in that luteal phase and or not in that luteal phase, from a higher fat to a lower carb, depending on the individual person. So again, depending on that, yeah, they're more susceptible to injury, more susceptible to fatigue and not recovering as much. So when I do have a female client who, again, some do have periods, some don't have periods, things like that, I will change that type of fatigue management strategy during that time to where they are having a little bit more decrease in intensity. The volume will stay the same, but the decrease intensity will kind of go down a bit just to maintain through that. And then once they kind of roll out of that again towards the end of that luteal phase, training will kind of increase. That does get tricky with programming, because then you're altering programming every third week or so. Which does get a little tricky in terms of writing block progressions. But again, then you write it more so in wave progressions. You know, writing that second and a half to third weekend, your wave will be the highest peak. You'll taper, you'll roar through it, and you come back down. So, yeah, I actually learned that through you guys. So once I kind of figured that out and started adapting, fatigue management recovery was way better. And then they weren't coming out having kind of a lagging period as they come out of that training. Because sometimes if the training stimulus was too high during that phase, it takes them a while to kind of catch up, and then they kind of get back into a groove. So, yeah.
Well explained. I want to kind of, do you guys have anything y'all want to say on that?
No, you just froze up again. I was like, oh shit.
Oh, fuck, man. Am I back?
All right. I think
yeah, you're good.
Am I back now?
Yeah, I think we're good, man.
I'm pissed off. I'm going to get with Comcast after this because I pay too much for this shit. You guys have any follow-up questions to that? Or I was going to wrap it up more towards my questions were about deloading, recovery, and feedbacks he watches. Because we're going to bring him on to talk about specific body parts down the road. But I kind of wanted to get like a basis understanding of this stuff, how he teaches it out. Do you guys have any questions so far? Or you want me to go with it?
I guess my question, JC, would be, you know, the comparison between deloads and taking complete time off. You know, what do you recommend is better, depending on the athlete's
goals? Yeah, good question. You're 100% correct. If I'm working with someone who's in a contest prep, taking time completely off really isn't going to be a solution. I might have an extended rest period, but a lot of times that depends on what their coach for nutrition or what I'm doing with nutrition for them. I don't do nutrition for some of my clients. Their coaches do it and I work with them synergistically. So depending on what their coaches do nutritionally during those times, I will adapt training based upon those protocols. I don't think people need a complete deload in terms of not going to the gym at all. And the reason why I say that is because, again, a lot of time for bigger clients, more muscular clients, and it's just relative. So if you have more muscle on your frame, a lot of time training is the only mobility work that you're actually getting. So you're essentially, you're just eccentrically loading into a stretch position when you're weight training. And a lot of times that's the only way for people that really do any mobility work. They don't sit there and do any passive or active stretching and stuff like that. So if they go from getting stretched out 3-4 times a week during their training, those joints moving and keeping lubricated, and they go to doing nothing, your body's just like going to seize. It's not going to feel comfortable. Now, if we take that deload and reduce volume and reduce intensity to maybe a minimum effective volume, and again, keeping it maybe at a more 4-5 RIR, but again, keeping the body moving, I feel like that allows us to get more out of recovery and puts us in a better place to continue training. Then again, having that gap of no training for X amount of days and then having a bigger gap to kind of get back to from not training. So you're still, it's almost like a super compensation effect, right? For powerlifting or something like that, where we kind of deload, come back to a higher position of performance. And that's kind of how I like to do things that way. But again, some coaches have their own opinions. I don't like to take a full complete deload off. You should be managing volume, intensity, and training, and looking at, again, as that person's kind of signals get kind of out there, I should say, is their weight stalling? Is their performance stalling? Is their technique breaking down? Different things like that to the point where you may need to take a deload, but not a complete off, you know?
JC, taking that this conversation to like extreme side, like do you see any benefit or is this something that you should never do? Right, is to do some sort of physical activity every day so that no matter what, every day you're doing something. You never have a true day off where you're not doing any physical activity. Is that recommended? In what situations would it be? If so,
honestly, the only time I would recommend to never take a day off is if you have any physical activity, is this if you absolutely for some reason had to do something every day. I mean, I don't see a reason why that is. I mean, just from a mental standpoint, I know that taking a day off just from completely, again, doing nothing in terms of actually going to do a cardio session or actually going to train is extremely healthy just for the mind, to be honest. Now I will say I'm probably on those days I'll go for a walk. but that's more like a meat-based walk, where I'm just gradually doing a walk. I'm not looking at my heart rate. I'm not looking at respiration rate, pulse, anything like that. I'm just walking. But yeah, I think for the mind, the body, the soul, it's just good to kind of get a day off here and there where you're just absolutely doing nothing but just recovering. And then again, you look forward to getting back to the gym and training the next day or the next 2 days and so forth. Man, I don't know if I've ever met someone that's always done something every single day and never had a day off. Have you?
I have, yeah. Physique competitor world, I mean, some of the women have body dysmorphia and they're addicted to training, and some of them don't take a day off at all. They train, you know, 6-7 days a week. because they're afraid that if they don't, they'll get fat.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I have some of my clients that are like that. Again, that usually takes in my point, the working with clients who can't hold themselves accountable to taking days off. Yeah. I guess understanding that mindset, like that more is not always better, but how you get that across to some people is a million different ways. I'm sure you guys have more practice in that than I do, but yeah, that's crazy. I drop more like 4 days per week of training and I'm loving it. So like I'm the complete opposite.
Yeah,
no, it's very difficult when you have that going on and someone believes they have to do something every day and their hormones and everything say the complete opposite. So it's a very interesting conversation to have.
At some point, I feel like there was something that happened or triggered the individual to say more is less, whether it was an experience, a coaching experience, a weight gain experience. It's got to be something that was a trigger. And I think finding that trigger and what led them to believe that more is better, right? And then going over that trigger is something that I've used and it kind of works well. But yeah, I mean, like, I definitely, between your work, working with Trina and me kind of seeing on the back end, like, the funny thing is I'm always looking at the back end of what you and Trina are doing together and I'm learning by osmosis, just kind of sitting here and listening to everything that's going on. Looking at the blood hormone panels and things like that and triggering nutrition is, you know, definitely huge.
Absolutely. What are some of the biofeedbacks that you watch in regards to training points? And then I'll put it to the guys if they got any final questions and then we'll tidy this one up.
Yeah. If most of the time I'm looking at progressions of, again, their volume, progressions of their technique. Are they standardizing their reps? Can they continue to standardize those reps with really good technique as they're progressing load, right? So that's the feedback I'm getting. If sometimes load can just be too much where they don't have the stability in order to kind of use that load, or they don't have the mobility to use that load, that feedback is telling me, okay, we've progressed load too much to the point now we've outworked or outgrown our stability needs and our mobility needs, and we have to regress and bring something up. So that might require choosing a different exercise until we bring those needs back up and then going back to a new exercise. I'm looking at, again, are they continually getting a pump? Can they continually feel that muscle? Is the connection with that muscle well? Is that stimulus high to where they're going through the exercises and they're continually feeling the muscle at the same strength, even though they're progressing volume, even though they're progressing load? Because sometimes as volume increases and as load increases, the amount of internal tension that you have to create and the amount of external tension that you have to create in order to use that load gets so high that you lose sensation of that muscle actually activating or feeling pumped. You know, like, for example, I'm sure someone who squats with 225, you know, for quads, and then they end up working to 415, the load difference is so big that sometimes the tension is so much that they lose sensation on those quads just because they have to activate everything else even more, right? So now, is that exercise appropriate for that individual, or do we need to now swap that exercise out for a more appropriate exercise that's going to have more stimulus but less fatigue? And so those markers I'm looking for as well. I'm almost looking for recovery markers as well. So are they being able to recover enough soreness-wise for the next training day? If that is consistently happening among multiple groups of muscles, then I know their volume is probably too high and we're overreaching, and or they're under-recovering, and nutrition and recovery needs to be looked at. Mm-hmm. So those are some other factors that I'm looking at. Are they getting enough sleep? So is their sleep shit? Sometimes, again, too hard of training or too heavy of training is going to put you into that sympathetic state and you're not recovering and getting a lot of sleep. Is there sleep shit? Training impacts that and sleep impacts training. So they go back and forth. So I look at those factors as well. Pretty much everything you guys do nutritionally, I do for programming. They all work together synergistically.
You dabble in anything HRV related to the recovery, or you find that to be too loose of a variable so far?
It's not so much too loose of a variable. It's that I don't like using a variable that really can't be auto-regulated, right? Because if you go by the markers of HRV, it's saying, oh, you're not recovered, but you may feel great. And you may know how to auto-regulate your training to the point where you may still be able to have a great effective training day just by reducing your volume slightly, or just by, again, maybe removing a set or two. and still have a productive training. I've seen too many people look at their HRV and be like, nope, can't train today. Thank God. That's not what that means. It just means, again, we may be sliding into one side of the scale or another. We may have to adjust a training day to maybe a different body part, but not training is going to be even more worse for, I think, where most of our people than just taking the whole day off. So,
Jeff, two things I want to interject here. And JC, you made a good point. I think, you know, in our society today with our technology, you know, people depend too much on the data and the numbers, and they get too fancy with things, and they stop being able to internalize their feelings and think about how their bodies are actually performing and feeling on a certain day. And they just, you know, trust the watch or the app or whatever. It's bullshit. And what you were saying before about balancing proper stimulus and overall fatigue of the CNS, I think a lot of guys, men especially, have an emotional attachment to certain movements. You can't have a good chest workout without bench pressing, or, you know, I tend to favor the hack squat, but I know that's not good for my hamstrings. You know, it's good for quads. And I actually had a contest prep, a guy in prep who was like, why did you take out my deadlifts, my bench, and my squats? And I said, well, you know, I don't want you fatiguing your nervous system. I'd rather have you stimulating the muscle. We keep muscle on you because he's natural, and not, you know, tax yourself because he's 6 weeks out now. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a small group that and those, that group is usually at the very, very elite level that can keep those exercises and at a very high level. And again, that's probably because their supplementation allows it for it, their training history allows for it, and their environment allows for it. But a lot of people can't duplicate any one of those factors that most people can. I think education is the biggest aspect of that when it comes to being like, yeah, dude, this is why we can't do this exercise right now. And this is what exercise is actually going to be better for you. Not saying we never can come back to it, but it's going to be more useful for your goals. But to go back to the HRV thing, yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing. Like before the whole HRV thing happened, like people were training, auto-regulating themselves completely fine. You're like, oh man, I feel like shit today. I might just do it a little bit lighter. Cool. You just auto-regulated your training versus like, oh no, my HRV is whatever. I have to stop training completely. Like, yeah. I think too much technology these days can be a bad thing.
Yeah, that's kind of like where, you know, I get that question a lot with HRV. Hey, I'm red. Should I take the day off? I'm like, no. You know, if after the first exercise you feel good, train. If after the first exercise you don't feel good, back off. You know what I mean? Like, there you go. Like, and I think that's the one big thing when I think where I apply HRV now more towards people is, that number is, it's reading it when you first get up. So obviously it's giving you insight into how you're sleeping and like all that kind of stuff that goes on. Not so much how you're prepared for the day, because, you know, as you get going for the day, you usually feel better depending upon the time of day you train. And I've had people wake up HRV green on Whoop and then still feel like trash. You know what I mean? And I'm like, look, that's just a sign into how you're recovering overnight with your sleep. And I would utilize HRV more for sleep habits than I really do kind of anything else as of late. And a lot of people are correlating that message better, I feel, than the snapshot of, oh, 6 a.m. It says I'm yellow, so I got to be all cautious the whole day. That's not the case. So I'm glad you said
that. Yeah, I think it's, again, it's a matter. Again, I've used it in terms of looking at how certain exercise swaps changes someone's ability to recover. So again, if I use an exercise that might have a higher demand for neural capacity, so like something like a deadlift where it's very sympathetic driven, I'll actually look at their HRV the next morning and see if that's kind of made any changes. And I have found trends in terms of when we've put those large muscle groups in, that we have seen that kind of HRV be on the lower side the day after. And then it slowly tempers up. But if we change that exercise to actually something more single joint and more isolated, the HRV is actually in a better place the next morning, just because you're not so sympathetic driven, you get better sleep and so forth. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it does show kind of how people can respond. Some people can deadlift 2-3 times a week. I am not one of those people, right? But if someone has that ability and they've built that capacity and it's not affecting that, then I'm going to keep it going for sure.
You guys have any questions before I ask my final one?
Yeah, I'm good.
Jason, if you're obviously in an audience with coaches, one, Where would you recommend coaches like go looking for this kind of education that you're immersed in? Like, you know, any good books, any good courses that you would recommend, you know, obviously besides following yourself. And then number two, do you do any mentoring or any kind of classes on this stuff?
As far as education goes, again, a lot of what I follow, what I do is I read the same articles you guys do a lot of times. I follow Chris Beardsley. I follow a lot of different people in terms of the academia aspect of it. Brad Schoenfield, those guys. I mean, there's not a whole lot that's being pioneered new these days. We're just interpreting the same data in different ways over and over and over again. And then we're seeing how that data applies in the field. And I think that's the biggest thing is we're able to now take that data that's being provided in the academic world, and now we're being able to transfer it over into the training world and seeing what works and what doesn't work. And that's where this new data is coming from. Like, I mean, just recently, how long ago was it that you guys realized that the last five reps to failure was what's key? How long ago was that when you heard that? I mean, 10 years ago, no one heard that. You didn't take into account the last five reps, you know, RIR were the best reps to hypertrophy. It's only been recently that we kind of just found that kind of information out. So it's bizarre as to what's coming out in terms of what's going on into the academic world and what's going on to that world. Honestly, a lot of my stuff I've found kind of in the gym, training my clients and so forth, kind of working through myself, and then kind of adapting what doesn't work and what does work in terms of programming and training. So, I mean, you do have to go search for it if you actually want it. But again, since there's a million ways to skin a cat in the hypertrophy game, you know, you can be right one day and you can be completely wrong the other. Unfortunately.
That's true in the nutrition world as well.
That's right.
And do you do any mentoring? And then finally, throw out your socials. I know you got a hell of a YouTube you're working on and a lot of cool stuff. So go ahead and take the floor.
Yeah, so I don't do any direct one-on-one mentoring in terms of programming. I think, I guess it hasn't really been a commodity that people have really gotten into. But I do in terms of, again, the training aspect and education. I do some work with other coaches and their trainers in terms of teaching programming and understanding hypertrophy programming. And not just programming for hypertrophy, but again, understanding how training programming works together in totality. Whether that's strength goals, lifestyle goals, things like that, basically how to structure and periodize stress and adapt based on your client's needs and wants. So I do that for a lot of, for different coaches. And then, yeah, I try and put a lot of good content on my Instagram. I try and put things up that are applicable. I don't like watering down my Instagram with things that I think just get redundant in terms of I see every day. So when I do put something up, I think it's applicable, maybe hasn't been said before. And then those are something else you asked.
You might want to say your social, like where people can find
you. Sure, I'll say that. Yeah.
And then YouTube and all that. Yeah, man, dude, you've sent it out there, baby.
Yeah. Jason Coley PR is the YouTube or the Instagram name. And again, Jason Coley at Performance Training Systems is the website. PR Systems Training is the website. If any guys have any questions, comments about training, programming, you guys can always set up a free consultation with me and kind of discuss kind of what your problems are. I'm currently almost full capacity at in-person training right now. So if you're in the Chicagoland area, hit me up online, always accepting new clients right now. And then the YouTube is going to be coming up where it's going to be really, really specific in terms of training, educational videos, hypertrophy based videos, things like that. Much like some similar to the other people have right now, but it's going to be a little bit more, put together in depth in terms of content.
Sweet, man. All right. So if you are listening to this episode today, we did a really good job. I feel through the points, getting to the end of educating you on where Jace's beliefs are on training, where we're all making mistakes, areas we can improve and areas we should be looking at to make the best training program possible. So in 2 weeks, we're going to bring him back on to talk about the application, how we would set up workouts for people. We need to hear from y'all. How do you guys want us to structure this? Do you guys want to attack a body part? beginner, intermediate, advanced, or do you guys want us to go over different splits? We would love to hear from you guys. Message the Excellence Cartel page to give us some insight so we can set up a bomb ass episode for you to make it really relatable on the application side, because that's going to be hard for us to do. So we need your guys' guidance as the listeners to help us out with this. With that being said, next week we're joined by Sarah Bishop Ford, where we are actually talking about female strength training and program. So that'll be a cool little segment going back into Jason's the following week. And then the very first week of October, we're bringing two coaches on to do a Q&A panel, and boy, are they completely different than us, but they will be joining us once a month to do something really cool that we're going to kind of spin out there to get, a female take on things, guys, because, I guess I'm not bitch enough for everybody, you know, with my metrosexual ways. But hey, look, I'm just being honest. I have a beautiful beard. I can't chop wood. I'm just telling you that shit 100%. So I thought the feminine energy in me would counterbalance you and Jason, but I guess I failed. So we're bringing on two women to join us, which is going to be a lovely, lovely, lovely time.
You see, what will be great when we have the women on board is that they'll tell you to shut up before you shoot yourself in the foot again.
I didn't fucking shoot myself in the foot there. I even said I was being a bitch. I'm the first person. Listen, I have to actually go consider buying a gun last week. And it was just because when I was helping move Chelsea in, I was watching weapon after weapon after weapon being moved in. I'm like, this girl's got like an armory. Like, I mean, I could just stand behind her and she protect me, but I made my man card feel a little violated. So now I'm going to go get a weapon. So much like I'm watering my yard, which will be great and green by the end of the year, I'm going to have a gun just to match you, Sue. I'm coming after you. I want your life.
Hey, my grass is green. I got my CZ right in my bookcase right there. So,
all right, guys. So y'all have yourself a good day. Jason, you got what, 4,000 more steps to do?
Man, it's close. Exactly.
Damn. Dude, I got your. How many does Trina have left?
5,000.
Ooh, got a little race. That's how it usually is by the end of the day. It's about 3,000 to 5,000 left to go.
Yeah.
Around 3 o'clock is usually what it is. So
I've got like 5,000 calories to eat for the rest of the day because I'm trying to gain weight because I'm the smallest among you guys here. So,
dude, I love looking at your dog diet Instagram. It makes me hungry every time I see it.
Makes you hungry every time you see it. Well, I'm going out to a really nice dinner tonight. I can't say where because someone's listening in the other room, but it's going to be a good dinner. So I'm excited. Now I'm hungry too. All right. Well, everyone but Jason's going to have a good night eating. All right. You'll have yourself a good night, guys. Have a
good night.
Peace. Thanks again, man. It was fun.